I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Martin Shaw to present his latest book, Stag Cult, beautifully published by Hazel Press.
Yeah.
Martin, as I'm sure you will know, is a mythographer, a shamanic bricoleur.
That's a good one.
He'll be in conversation with Claire Armitstead from The Guardian for about 45 minutes, after which there should be time for questions, after which there will certainly be time for the buying and signing books. And join me in welcoming our guests.
Thank you.
So I'd imagine this is quite a fan club, isn't it? Have you all come here because you've been drawn by the power of Martin's storytelling? Or have you come here out of curiosity? How many people are pre-existing fans? Yeah, well, we've got some people who've come out of curiosity over here.
Good.
You will be in for a treat, I have to say. I didn't know anything about Martin before I started reading this. And I was saying it is a sort of extraordinary book, and I have asked him to read a particular story which sums up partly my experience of it, but also seems somehow essential to the book as an introduction. And I was looking back through his previous book titles, which the list of previous book titles is like a sort of a folk story in itself, and I will give you a few of them. I mean, there is just a few of them. A Branch from the Lightning Tree, Ecstatic Myth and the Grace of Wildness. Snowy Tower, Parsifal and the Wet Black Branch of Language.
Yeah.
The Wet Black Branch of Language.
Yeah.
Scatterlings, Getting Claimed in the Age of Amnesia. And I've just discovered Smoke Hole, Looking for the Wild in the Time of the Spyglass, which I didn't know about, which is downstairs. And you wrote in, actually, during lockdown for your daughter.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And now we have Stag Cult in this beautiful little edition. Just explain for the people who don't know about you.
Yeah.
What exactly are you?
Well, I, having spent a few days in London, I know I'm rural. So I am. I'm this endangered species called a mythologist, and I do implore, if nothing else, you leave this evening with the notion that maybe you could be a mythologist too, because there aren't many of us left. And mythologist is simply someone that loves old stories, loves all the different layers of them, and believes most fervently that a story from 4,000 years ago can be telling us something about what happened on the way to the bus in the morning. They're kind of always... Myth really is not to do with a long time ago. Not really, not at its deepest level. So I'm a mythologist. I'm something called a wilderness rites of passage guide. So I've been taking folks way out into the bush for 25 years. I've had an academic life as a Stanford professor and running MAs in this country. Devoted dad, you know. Yeah.
And so this book is it sort of illustrates everything you've said, but it's more personal than a lot of your other work.
It is. Yeah, it's a new move, I think. I don't know about you, but I, at the end of lockdown, as soon as I was in contact with other people, I realised that I was mad as a box of frogs. I'd been alone in a cottage for the best part of a year and I thought I was doing terribly well. But then as soon as I got to the greengrocers and tried to speak, it was in Elvish. So when Daphne, my friend at Hazel Press, said, look, you know, we'd be interested in something. And I started to write, and it was in the last few weeks that I remained in the cottage that I'd been living in for 5 years. Something unusual happened, just more personal stories started to turn up. And actually, in bits sort of secreted in Stag Cult, it's a bit of a love story to some of the women in my family. You know, it's my Auntie Mettie, my Auntie Jenny, some of the women that aren't alive anymore, but are very much real presences in my life. But rather than me saying, let me tell you about Auntie Jenny, she would show up in the story of Ceridwen. So the myth world and my personal story got all woven up in this wild little book.
So this is since Ceridwen appears in this bit that I've asked you to read.
You have. Would you like me to read it?
Let's read it.
Are you ready for a story?
Yeah.
Oh, no. It's not going to work like that. The story has got to come all the way from Snowdonia. So I'll have to, we need a bit more voice in the room. Are you ready for a story?
Yeah.
That's it. That's good. Okay. I will read it. So this begins with a chap called Gwyn Bach, and he is talking about a couple of people he knows. We knew of the two of them living up at Bala Lake, a witchy wife, Ceridwen, and her vast husband. She was the power source in their relationship. There are those that will tell you she is a goddess. Others a woman with a few herbs and time on her hands. I will argue a third way, the blue feather in the magpie's tail. I think she was a bit of both. She had real proper knowing, not good or bad, black or white, but substantial magical knowledge. Some of us in the village, we knew a spell or two, the occasional curse mutter, but she had been at it, hammer and tongs, since Noah's flood. She outranked everyone. We were scared of her, but in a way that was exciting, not eviscerating. You know what it's like when you're scared of someone in a good way? Always good to know the difference. So Ceridwen, the old woman, she had two kids. She had a boy and a girl. We all fancied the girl. How could you not? To not adore her was like not loving dusk or black beer. Or a chop. To not adore her was to not love life. We could see her way would be a bright path. She was about my age, but it's her brother that was the problem. Her brother was all kind of mangled up, a big old ugly mess. His name was Morfan. If she was light, he was night. And it wasn't a tantalizing darkness. It wasn't a rich, sexy darkness. It was going to be wretched and filled with pain for him. A blindness that no Homer could negotiate. So mother, as all mothers should, gets to work. It can be grand to have a mother that's a witch. She knew there wasn't much she could do with Morfan's exterior other than drag a comb through his hair. But his interior was different. She could make her son glow. She could light him up from the inside. She could bring inspiration to him. And if he was to have any luck at Arthur's camp, he'd need to be a sage, a wit, even a prophet, not a runty little crow. Ah, I said the magic name, didn't I? Arthur. Before Camelot, before Swords in Stones, before Round Tables, before he was even referred to as a king, just Arthur. But he was great, even then. The idea, it's the idea of Arthur, was what we as a people circled around. There was meat and mead just in uttering his name. Ceridwen wanted Morfan in his orbit, under his wingspan, seeing things as he did. So Cara Dwen is now going to make the great potion of her life. Her son is going to go to the ball, effectively. It was a year and a day, the ancient terms, and a cauldron that was loaded up with all her herbs, her mutters, her bones. She would cook away until it finally spat 3 drops of the pure stuff, the real ticket, the weird, the big word, Arwen, into the mouth of her son. He was excited, but excused from the labour of preparation. But me, as a young local lad with time on his hands, got roped into stir. A geriatric from the settlement, Morda, was to keep the kindling ticking over. Blind as blind is, so he was. So when Ceridwen wiped his eye out, or swiped his eye out, it didn't make much difference, and I will get to that. Ceridwen was not to be refused, so we cracked on. All year we grafted on the spell. The seasons got chucked into different chants, herbs, sacrificing, depending on the time of the year and the movement of the moon. Ceridwen was relentless, barely taking a shift off, rarely kipping. For all that liquid in the cauldron, it was only, remember only this, 3 drops that was going to be any good. The rest would kill you, straight up poison. So she had to get it right. It was mistressful watching her. And it's now, all these years later, that I realise what I learned from her education. My people, and peoples like us, we make these pots, these cauldrons. On the outer rim of the pot are all sorts of shapes and symbols to be deciphered by outsiders. But on the inner rim of the pot are other insignias, images that can only be deciphered by insiders. Hidden stuff. The difference being what you could call explicit and tacit. And it was the tacit stuff that was getting cooked, stewed and stretched down in the cauldron. I'd look down at crouching Morda, he's the old guy at the bottom, as my stirring arm ached. I'd look into his milky, unseeing eyes and not knowing that Ceridwen was teaching us how to become alchemists. She's teaching us how to become alchemists. Now, we were getting to the end of the stretch. We'd maybe lost track of time. The fumes from the cauldron were overpowering. For once, Ceridwen wasn't towering over us. My knackered stirring arm was going round and round. She'd gone to sleep. I heard a sound from the cauldron I'd never heard before, like a stag at bay, a roar, and it all happened so fast. 3 drops spurted from the bubbling onto my hand. You know what I did? I did what you would have done, what we all would have done. I stuck my thumb straight in my gob to cool it down. Just like dear Finn and the Salmon of Wisdom. Just like all the Wonder Girls and the Wonder Boys of folk tales, it just happens that way. There wasn't malice, there wasn't even ambition. I didn't want to rob her son of his moment. It just bloody hurt. This was the heavy, heavy dose his mum had cooked up. So I mentioned a word, Arwen. And to think in Arwen is not like normal thinking. And I'm not even sure it is thinking. I was flung into something I would never return from. There is a cord of light that bangs out from me to Ceridwen, like echolocation, but I can see it. A fire trail in the whipping air, and I know she's awake and she's after me. She didn't work that hard, that fucking long, stretch herself half mad on magical austerities to see me gobble down the good stuff. I didn't hear her fury. I didn't see her fury. I felt her fury push into me like a boxer's blows. I ran for my life, and as I ran, I fell. I didn't change into the shape of a hare. I fell into the shape of a hare. I fell into that mad buck-tooth magic between those gnashers that don't ever stop growing. The chewer, the fellow in the rain, the double back of the stag of the brush, I fell into hair. Now, in your time, it was minutes, but in my new startling quadrant of dreaming, it was aeons. Now, Ceridwen, she became a cauldron and leathered after me, a slobber and proper garish in her rage. So into the soft dimension I leapt, into the greening river as a fish, again a falling, not a contortion. She became an otter, furious and vigilant, till I pushed my mind into wet feathers and erupted from the froth as a bird, she twisting from otter to hawk. I have to tell you again, so you are understanding this with me. These things took place over immeasurable time. I was in the future of wherever you are now, reading me. This took place in a place that hasn't happened yet. I finally fell into a grain of wheat. She now a black hen, and she gobbled me up. Was I in the cauldron? Was I in her belly? Was the cauldron always her belly? Was the potion made of estrogen and amniotic fluid? These things I cannot talk about. It'll cheapen the whole thing. But I was born again, like the Christians. This was my second birthday. I was a baby again, a baby brewed in the belly of a woman who wished to kill me. A woman who was there when she saw me but could not throttle me or slip in a blade to my folds. A woman who wrapped me in swaddling, placed me in a coracle and gave me to the fates and to the waters. Like Moses, like Dionysus, like dear Tristan. I am Taliesin. I am Shining Brow. And thousands of years on, there is still energy in my name. Thousands of years on, there is still energy in this story.
Well, I rest my case. There is energy in that story, isn't there? And I'm fascinated by how you manufacture the energy. And I love the fact that it seems to me that this is the three drops. This collection is the three drops. It's sort of storytelling distilled down, right down. So it's not just, you know, you might say it's a short book, but I thought, oh, it won't take me very long to read, but it did take me long to read. And then I had to read it again because I wasn't sure that I'd quite unfurled it.
Mm. Do you know those little German loaves of bread that look very small and then you pick them up and they're like the weight of a brick? I think it's a bit like that. Yeah. It's like kind of heavy rye bread. And everything that's in this book poured out. I mean, I'm trying to remember, Daphne, how it happened. But I remember I'd send you an email and say something more has happened. Something is happening. Something is happening. I'd send it to you. It would come back. It would Aikido the shape. It would move back and forth. But in there, just like it is in all our lives, there are moments where things just trip off the tongue, but they're very hard won. And I think the secret to storytelling, you know, in any medium is where your erudition as lightly as possible. And that's what I was trying to do in that book, is to tell ancient stories as if we were sitting in the pub and I was saying, Claire, you're not going to believe what happened next. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to do, really.
Mm. And that section, it opens with Joseph Beuys curling himself into the shape of a hare.
Yes.
What does Joseph Beuys have to do then?
Do you know who Joseph Beuys is? Got an idea for Joseph Beuys? Joseph Beuys is a totemic, troublesome figure in my own life, really. And as a young art student of about 25 years ago, the idea that there'd been a Luftwaffe officer who'd been shot down created this sort of strange mythology that his body was filled with shrapnel, which it was, rescued by the Tartars, wrapped in felt, and then I felt had become a kind of grief man for Germany after the unmentionable had happened, after the Second World War. He kind of crawls around modern art in a very ancient way. And Beuys has this lovely phrase. He says, in times like this, we need an enchanter. In times like this. So Beuys was my kind of enchantment. And so he naturally turns up. I realise that in Stag Cult, because I think like most writers, by the time you've written it, you need to walk away from it. You don't look at it for a while. And if you're lucky, If you're lucky, the book will be so alive, it won't be where you put it down. It'll be in another room in the house. And stag cult is definitely moves around the house. So every time I open it up, I'm sort of, you know, I'm surprised by what's in it. But Boyce just turned up as a totem figure and wouldn't go away. And there was more Boyce in it, and there's less Boyce in it now. But he was important to me. Funnily enough, though, that word enchantment that I used, I'm sort of the opposite of that. In my own work as an oral storyteller, people often say to me, what you're doing, I do like what it's so enchanting. It's so enchanting. But actually, I feel that we live in trance states half the time anyway. I do. You know, that my phone is a very mixed blessing. It's a very, very mixed blessing. So I'm always looking to wake up. And weird for me, mysterious, mystical stories, I feel more alive and more clear.
Mm. He's not the only artist that you name check. Cy Twombly is another one.
Cy Twombly was in there. I have a long background. Some of you will know this. I'm a painter. And if things had gone better for me, no books would have been written and I'd still be bloody painting. But someone, I'm going to be discovered at some point, I'm sure of it. Yes, in many, many years ago, I spent a summer in Italy at something called the British School in Rome. I was a young fledgling painter and I was really interested in this painter, Cy Twombly. If you don't know him, do go and have a look at his work. Twombly is especially interesting for me because I think he was great, even greater towards the end. And I love that. I love that when the maturity of a life, you remember Yeats, he says old men should be explorers. Old women should be explorers. We should all be fucking explorers. We should go out. What's life without a quest? What's life without a quest? So Twombly was someone that pushed the edges of his imagination to the end. So he's in the book as well. And Ai Weiwei.
And Ai Weiwei, a lovely line from Ai Weiwei.
Can I tell that story?
Of Ai Weiwei. That's a wonderful.
You know
story.
Who Ai Weiwei is? Very strange thing. There was a video a few years ago of me being interviewed in North Carolina. It was a very hot day. I'm not good in the heat. But it was seen, bizarrely, by Ai Weiwei. And he sent news to his arts foundation. He said, I found who I want to write my next catalogue. And they said, well, who would it be? You know, and he said, well, it's this guy. I think he's in a tent and he's in Devon and we'll find him. So out of nowhere, they say, it's a true story. Can you be in Berlin in 3 days? And I said, well, yes, of course I can, of course, you know. So I go to meet Ai Weiwei, and the project is all about myth as migration, which is something I'm really interested in. Like so many of us in the room, there's all these kind of umbilical cords crossing oceans. We're connected in all sorts of different ways. And that really was what we were talking about. But here's the thing. Here's the magical thing. He said, I'm interested in you because you love myth. He said, my father in the late 50s was a famous Chinese poet, but not known at all in the West. And we were taken to an internment camp in Mongolia where all his books on mythology were burnt in front of me. And so there's a pile of books. And he says, I remember seeing the guard throw the Odyssey onto the fire. And he said, but those things were my father's great heart. And he then got sad and he sat on the chair and he said, the great grief in my father's life was that he was never published in the West. He wasn't known in the West. And that was a source of so many things that gave him nourishment. And part of my work as an artist is holding up his side of the family name. So this is very moving to have this conversation. I have a book in my bag that I brought with me, apropos of nothing. It's called The White Pony, and it's an anthology of classical Chinese poetry that was very popular with people like Gary Snyder and the Beats in the late 50s. Bly, you know, got it from me. So it's an important book. And I said, oh, look, there's all these old poems in it. And as he's talking about his dad, I see that there's a section at the back called New Poets. And I'm like, oh, fuck. You know, you can just feel all the hairs going up. And we opened the back of the book up and he said, Daddy, Daddy. And there it was. There it was. There's two or three poems from his father and effusive praise written for him, saying, you know, this is one of the great Chinese poets. This is a man who draws from Van Gogh, who draws from Bach, who draws from here, there, and other. And I realized that actually, in the way how magical life is, the whole point of me being there was not to write the catalogue. It wasn't for my personal benefit. It was to give him the book. It was to give him the book, but I didn't know, and that's the sweetness. I didn't turn up like, wait till I do this. It just happened. And so all production in Ai Weiwei's enormous factory stopped for the day, and all the kids gathered around, the young artist, and he just read his father's poems. And a lot of the poems, you'll probably know this in Chinese poetry, there's a lot of honouring of the moon. And just as I was leaving, and I was absolutely shell-shocked by what had happened, I can't tell you how significant it was, I'm just walking to the door, and he calls out, and he says, tell the West we want the moon back. Tell the West we want the moon back. The moon isn't to be walked upon. The moon is a woman. So that was me done in Berlin. Yeah, so that's one of the stories that's in the book. Yeah.
Going to take you back to what it was like to read as opposed to tell this story. This yes. is a distillation of lots of stories you've told before.
Yeah.
What was it like to read it out of the book?
What, just then?
Yes.
Kind of difficult, because as you there's a few familiar faces here, and they will know that the way I actually tell, it's very much about wondering in public, imagining in public. And usually the conditions of a story mean I can't really rehearse it. Because as soon as I am kind of navigating my imagination in a pre-adorned way, I'm not favoured anymore by the gods of the stories. They, like, don't come. And what you get is bad acting. And that is something, if there's any fledgling storytellers here, acting's wonderful, theatre is an amazing thing, but the real rub of oral storytelling is that tightrope where you go out and you don't quite know what's going to happen next. So actually doing it was fun, but really different to how I'd normally tell that tale.
Mm. You've worked with Mark Rylance and with Paul Kingsnorth, yep, and with other people who work in slightly different way.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, I love it. And, you know, if anybody, I'm looking to experiment. You know, you've got to keep things interesting. So, I worked a few years ago, actually. I worked with Mark Rylance. We did it recently. Yeah, we did it. Richard, I ended up at Laurence Olivier's house with his son, Richard Olivier, with Mark, doing this kind of thing where I'll tell a story and he will play parts of the story. So he'll be a daughter or he'll be a wild, depraved king. But he's phenomenal, as you can imagine, with improvisation. So I'm very interested personally in work. I'd like to work a bit within theatre where we had actors around, but there was a little air in the room in terms of what's being said. I know there's something to do with oral storytelling in theatre that I'm meant to do, but it hasn't happened yet.
And you're exploring ways of doing it with people. You only go to the best, obviously.
Well, yes. Yeah, you know, you want to work with people that are brilliant. Here's a thought. I've been thinking this recently. I don't think I'm remotely intelligent, but when I'm around interesting people, I get smarter. I get more imaginative. And I live in a place where good conversation could be quite hard to find. Rural Devon, you know, there's a lot of beautiful things, but conversation, I think there's a real argument that intelligence often lives between people and is sparked. So I'm looking for those sparks because I have all sorts of thoughts that I simply don't have when I'm alone at the desk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When I was reading this, I come from a line of fraternal twins, and there are all sorts of funny things happen with twins. And I was saying, you must be a twin, but you're not a twin, but you have written a book about twins.
I have, yeah, Courting the Wild Twin. Yeah, yeah. No, I haven't. I don't think I've had a twin. Although, let's think about this. There is an old idea that it's a fairy tale idea, that on the night you were born, you had a twin that you don't know about. and the midwife threw her or him or whoever they are out of the window. And that in actual fact, it is the business of growing into a human being, which takes a really long time, to find that twin that culture at large would rather you didn't know about. This is an old Greek idea. It's your daimon, really. And I think I did grow up suspecting there was somebody wilder than me. There was somebody definitely having more fun than me. And I could hear it in music. At night, I'd hear my parents playing Vaughan Williams from downstairs, Fantasia on a Theme for Thomas Tallis, or Billie Holiday, or A Love Supreme by Joel Coltrane. And I was like, I can feel that there's just something out there. It's this questing idea again. I've got to go out and find it. So that book is full of, there's a Persian poet called Hafez, and he basically says this, the job of us is to go around chucking keys into prison cells. Like whoever you know who feels lost, give them a key. And what I'm trying to do in my own work and in my life is gather as many keys, because people have been very generous with me, like the Ai Weiwei story. So you want to keep moving them on, because within myth, the world will give you as much beauty as you can handle, providing you're prepared to pass it on. So don't hoard it. That's the key.
Mm. So what you gave to me was the idea of Taliesin and Morfinn being twins in a way, that the dark twin and the twisted twin and the twin who consumes.
Yes. Here's an idea about exile twins. What you exile will grow hostile towards you. What you exile grows hostile towards you. So if that twin disappears off, when they meet you again, they won't high-five you. There'll be trouble. And this is, you know, every therapist understands this, is, you know, a decent, embodied, soulful life is going to involve you rummaging around in the dark and going, oh, I haven't seen you for a while. And they say, well, you didn't let me out of the cellar, you nutter. And that courtship has to begin.
Yeah. Tell us about Arwen.
Well, Arwen is a word. It's also a person. This is someone here who's called Arwen. It's an energy, really. It is absolutely blessed inspiration. It's very Welsh in its nature. And it's a kind of holy moment. My mum comes from a particular sort of Christianity. It's called nonconformist. And they are not fans of people in robes. So they believe in divine inspiration, but they don't like all the accoutrements that go with it. And when the Arwen falls, and this could even be in like a Quaker house, the person like steps forward and announces this moment is on them, this prophetic idea or moment of inspiration. But then you sit down again and you regain your smaller shape. But the Arwen is, you know, I mean, Lorca would call it, Arwen and Duende aren't the same. They're not the same. Duende's, you know, it's that stuff. It's all sex and, well, you know, it's sex and death and flamenco and crows. It's all that. Arwen is a bit more Hildegard von Bingen, you know. But it's a beautiful thing. And, in the cauldron, I'm sorry, some of you...
Oh, yeah, we need to talk about the cauldron. We haven't
The cauldron, Ceridwen's cauldron, has in it what Lady Charlotte Guest, at least, calls all knowledge of science and all knowledge of inspiration, both. But once the pot gets tipped, the two mixtures separate out, and ever since there's been a kind of ongoing pain between the artists and the scientists, but the original bardic shape has all of it in the cauldron. Mm.
So now you talk about peering into your bog cauldron.
Yes.
And that is the sort of place at which it starts.
Yeah. So you know who Seamus Heaney is? Yes. Seamus Heaney, in the late 60s and early 70s, along with Ted Hughes, and I think everybody at the time, all the poets at the time, were very interested in the bodies that started to be found perfectly preserved in peat. And there's this wonderful book called The Bog People, which you must scuttle home tonight and find and read. And this is the thing. Whenever they found a perfectly preserved body in the peat, they designated that area a bog cauldron. And it was the middle of winter. I think I was in a power cut. I was sitting in the cottage with a candle. And I thought, well, I bet there's a bog cauldron in me. I bet there's a figure. Do you know, like babushka dolls? And you open up one, and then there's another one, and then there's another one, and then there's another one. I realized that within me were young women and giants and salmon and hawks. And an old guy that never stops crying. You know, all of this is going on inside me. So I just worked into that idea, and I'd sleep on it. And that's gradually one bog cauldron, one acupuncture point in me after another keeps opening up.
Mm. So you've sort of given yourself therapy, lifelong therapy is one way
yeah.
of looking at it.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, the word therapy, because I've come round to thinking it's a very sensible thing is to have a therapeutic, you know, what are your options to not do that? People use the word self-help as if it's bad. I'm like, you mean, we're talking about self-reliance. This is me learning the story. It's like looking, this book is like a cave painting and you're holding a torch up and you can just see bits of the wall and there's the movement of the deer or there's a stag or there's something like that. And I'm just trying to discern what I can see. And I know as a fact, if this is going on for me, it's surely going on for you. It'll be down there somewhere. Mm. Yeah. So it does have in the noblest sense of it, it does have a sense of the therapeutic about it.
Mm. So now we mentioned right at the beginning that it was more autobiographical than most
yes.
of your writing. And,
yeah.
and it begins with an occulted birth.
Yes. Yes.
Which is that your head is facing a different way to your body.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a metaphor. Just before we get too excited, I'd better clear that up before my mother will. My mother will ring up and say, that's not true. That's not true. What I mean by that is I grew up in the 1970s and I grew up facing Thatcher's Britain and I grew up facing Culture Club and whatever, you know, Spandau Ballet and something called GCSE. Some of you will know them. And but I knew behind me, my body was shaped towards Connemara and all sorts of ancestral stuff and all these old stories and Robin Hood and Arthur and all of that. But like everybody, I was kind of contorted in these two different positions. And when I turned 50, which I did almost a year ago, I thought, fuck that. I want my whole body going in this particular direction. I mean, there just comes a point, doesn't there? You know, enough. But like everybody, I was so multifarious in influence. It's taken a long time to find what I stand for, you know. And I do feel that. I'm very old-fashioned. I was talking to an old Orthodox priest the other day, and he said to me, he said, what you need, boy, he didn't say boy, he was nicer than that. He said, you need to remember the words, noblesse oblige. Noblesse oblige. He said, you, and he was talking about something that was going on in my life, have been dragged out of the shit and are dining with princes. And that means you've been given a phenomenal opportunity in your life. And it means if you are noble, act noble. So get on with it. Be decent, you know. So somehow all of this stuff in there is a move towards trying to find out what, in a time like this, noblesse oblige could look like.
Mm.
That'll be the next book, maybe.
So you mentioned that you're an artist.
Yeah.
You haven't talked about your musical career yet.
No, there's a reason.
And the importance of Thin Lizzy in your life.
Oh, my God. Thin Lizzy. Yeah, when I was about, I mean, I grew up, okay, now we're way off track, but I have to tell you.
No, it's in the book.
When I was eight, I was telling you about this. When I was eight, I became something called a rude boy. Now, my mother said, you are very rude, and if ever there was a time. But can you imagine, I was an eight-year-old Devonian rural lad thinking he was a Jamaican Yardie, walking around the, you know, trying to save up something called a Harrington jacket. And so music was important to me. It was originally that kind of world. I was a little rude boy. Then I heard the Kinks. I heard a cassette and the Kinks, The Kinks. Oh, my God. And then I heard Thin Lizzy and this the amazing Phil Lynott. I mean, Phil Lynott, black, Irish. Tell me the story of young Cuchulainn, his expression dark, his face was sullen, and how he fought and always won. You know, that stuff when you're 10 and all around you is you know, whatever was in the charts at the moment. It was like going from drinking water to Lagavulin, if you know what that is. So, yeah, there's a bit of love for Thin Lizzy in the book as well. And, yeah, and of course I talk about being a drummer.
You did?
I did, yeah. Yeah, well, that was my rite of passage, the summer of 88. You know, I was playing the highways and byways of Europe, all the squats, punk rock, hard, something called hardcore that came out of punk, all of that stuff. Terrible tinnitus that I have to this day. So as I'm talking to you, there's the applause from the last gig forever that I have in my ears, unfortunately. So, yeah, there's the music. And I have to say, I don't think this is in the book. I got a job in a factory. And with the first week's pay packet, I got 75 quid. I went down to the music shop and I bought LA Woman by the Doors, which I really loved, and I loved the drumming. I am now in a band with two members, with me and the drummer from the Doors, John Densmore. Yes, we've been... And if you do not believe me, which I quite understand, Google Martin Shaw, John Densmore, Hollywood, and you will find us playing in a nightclub called Kayak's Woodshed from about 10 years ago. So I send that back to my little self working in the factory and go, keep going, kiddo, you know.
We were talking downstairs about how we forget names, both of us forget names. But your memory for story, your memory, you're all the time reciting from this huge reservoir of unforgotten things. Mm. How is that? How can those two things exist in you?
It exists because I keep so much else out. You know, I don't live in a world. I know that my energy is limited these days. It's not like it was when I was 30. So there's a lot I simply choose not to think about. In oral culture, we didn't have all these devices to catch everything. So we were finite. You know, a word in Hebrew means an event. It's an event. And so I choose my events really carefully. And I also live a life where quite a lot of the time I'm consciously on my own, because I have to have a kind of imaginative space around me to draw all of this stuff in. So that's how I do it. I'm just very selective.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I think that it's time to open it out to questions. You all have different parts of the work that you want to ask questions about. You might even ask for another story. You might know what story you want to ask for. So who's going to be the person? Yes, we've got the first one. Thank you.
Hi, it's an honour to see you speak tonight. I'm a huge admirer of Robert Blyme, and I know that you had an intense relationship with him.
Yeah.
Can you talk about his effect on you with your writing and your storytelling, please?
I will, yeah. You're not called Harry, are you?
I am.
Thought so. Robert Bly.
So go on, tell us, how did you know?
Oh, no, that was, you know, that's enough information. Yeah. The other Harry says hello. Yeah, Robert Bly, for anyone that doesn't know, recently went to his reward at about 96 years of age. He was a phenomenal firebrand Norwegian-American poet, absolutely revolutionized poetry in America, especially in the 60s and the 70s. In the 80s, he wrote a book. Robert was leading a conference called the Great Mother Conference, very influenced by second wave feminism, very influenced by writers like Marie-Louise von Franz. How does myth talk about the feminine, the female, but also the feminine? So this whole conference was set up like this. And then a lot of the mums had kids and they had boys. And when the boys got to about 14, they said, look, our sons don't want to hear The Handless Maiden. Have you got anything else? And he went away and wrote a book called Iron John. Iron John sells 2 million copies. So this Norwegian Lutheran suddenly becomes very rich and very famous and the rest of it. And that was all that I knew. He lived over there. And then suddenly, about 16 years ago, when I was working 4 jobs and I was a young dad, I got a message from him that said this: come to America, I want to make a fuss of you. Imagine. This is how weird that is. This is so weird. It's like you are playing guitar in a Norfolk pub and someone from behind the bar says, I've got a text from Howling Wolf. You know, he wants to see you. He's in the south side of Chicago. Get your stuff. I swear to you, it was that monumental. I arrived in America. I got robbed at Newark Airport. Long story. And met in an hour, I met Robert Bly, James Hillman, Jane Hirschfield, Colman Barks, and it goes on and on and on. And my life absolutely like that changed. So Bly, within 3 years, Bly retired from that conference, and to everybody's huge annoyance, not everybody, but a lot of people's annoyance, I took over kind of curating it as an art. And I learned by mistakes, and I learned Robert's dear friend is a woman that's also been important to me, Gioia Timpanelli. And Gioia Timpanelli, who they call her the Dean of American Storytelling, Gioia always said, you know, a story from a long time ago has to earn its place in modernity. And she said, whenever I tell you a story, like me as a young apprentice storyteller, think of it like a recipe that's been passed down in a family. And for a year, you cook it in the way Auntie told you to cook it. And then one day, one evening, you've had a bit of wine, you discover smoked paprika, and you just add that little bit. But you don't mess with the majority of the thing. And that's how that robust approach is the influence that Robert had on me, and his capacity to take a group down and to say the thing that everyone was frightened to say. He was very brave, and to me, he was very kind. And I knew I was walking around with someone that shook mountains, you know, and that changes you. You're never the same when you've met someone that really has really lived in a particular type of way. I can't imagine him now. Like, I can't imagine him in 2022, but I miss him.
What did you mean by take a group down?
Robert... And it's something that's a big part of the work that I do as well. Robert, to use an Irish quote, how can I be with you if I'm not sad? You know, Robert had a lot of heartbreak. His stepson was killed, and he was killed in the middle of a conference. And Robert, for all his high spirits and his gaiety, had that Norwegian sorrow in him. And he learned bit by bit that actually most of us have to relearn how to grieve in public and to grieve together. And so we worked a lot with, say, returning veterans. We worked with people coming back from all sorts of catastrophically difficult situations. So that's the descent. And within myth, in Russian myth, that's called katabasis, the descent. Mm.
You have this line about the emergence of the Renaissance, the Irish Renaissance, out of the famine.
Yes.
Which is from the rupture of trauma, something that feels true.
Yeah, yes. Well, I think so, and I've learned that as a young storyteller. I was very neurotic about being, you know, as eloquent and as funny and as witty as possible. People don't care about that. People want to see you trying to tell the truth in public. That's what they want. And when you do that, you move from a transactional experience to a transformative experience. And that's what stories are. It's like deeper truths. The Mexicans call stories the river beneath the river. You got the facts. We've got Ukraine. We've got Russia. We've got the pipes. We've got... And what is that understory? And that's something that you cannot get to without the myth world, I think.
Mm. Thank you. It was a good answer, wasn't it?
Hello, Martin. Thank you very much. I have a question. When you began your reflections on this book, Stag Cult, about a message about the relational feminine coming through, particularly for you and in your family, and I might have misinterpreted that or I might have put my own lens on it, but I would love to hear more about that, and I'd love to hear more about the impact and the importance of that for you personally and for your reflections on what is important for us at this time.
So is it, I'm sorry to... It's just because I'm...
Did you not get it?
Yeah,
can the women coming through.
Yeah.
So...
It's all right. I think I got it. I think it's just been paraphrased.
Yep.
So, yes, just to go back to something I mentioned, I realised as I went along in the book that the women in my family who were very, and are, you know, eccentric, incorrigible, brilliant, sometimes fantastically bad-tempered, I'd just been around that my whole life. And, you know, the thing, I like women. I really like them. Of all shapes, sizes, dispositions, it's a place I like to be in, not in some creepy way, you know, just quite genuine. And I realised, I thought, well, where did that come from? And I just thought it was because I was around my Auntie Jenny and I was around my mum, I was around my sister, we were just around, and they just told stories. My dad tells stories too. My dad's a great storyteller. And I found when I started to write Stag Cult, and Daphne is the publisher of Hazel, who I'm thrilled to be doing this with. I said, Daphne, there's a lot about my life coming out. She was like, keep it coming, sweetie. Keep it coming. So I was like, well, okay. And so these characters like my Auntie Mettie are as important to me as Joseph Boyce, more so, but in a really different way. And to reiterate, I know I've said this before, but it's all about taking the ground you stand upon seriously. Take your weird little family seriously. Entertain the horrific notion that the gods wanted you to be born into the family you're in and the circumstances that have come towards you. It doesn't mean that they're good or you can approve of them, you can rally against them, but that's what I'm trying to do with my books. Tom Waits has a great phrase. He says, a song needs an address. We need a postcode. You know, everything is so universal and so global. I like specificity. So this book, what I'm trying to do is honor my ancestral dead, honor the strange lineage of these women in the family, and especially my mum, who's still very much alive, and prompt others to do something similar, I hope.
Thank you, Martin. I have a question. You talked during COVID of sort of being a sort of an initiatory process, and things just seem to be getting weirder. And I wonder what you might say around collective initiation or transformation, and where are we?
Thank you. Recently, you know, I can only talk about these things in very small way, that otherwise they're not very real to me. I had a group of male friends came around to see me, guys in their 50s who I just love, and we've all had kids, and you know, we're all kind of mad, and we're all sitting there, and I suddenly said, about 1 a.m, I said, am I the only one who post lockdown feel a bit lost? It's not there's different kinds of lostness. It's not as if it's unhelpful, but I'm not as sure on my feet as I was 4 years ago, and I'm probably the better for it, but I'm not the same. And to my astonishment, all the guys went, yeah, yeah, I don't know, I don't quite know where I am. And I've met very, in my line of work, some very significant spiritual teachers recently who've all said, what the fuck? So the truth is, I think, you know, do you remember the worry was, in a way, with lockdown, the worry was that it would finish and it would all go back to normal and we'd forget. No, no, no. We've drunk some kind of metaphysical Kool-Aid. But what I can't do is offer any platitudes that it could possibly culturally be a good or a bad thing. We don't really know yet. It's, in a way, I'll finish in a second with this. Think of your house during lockdown as an alchemist's hut. And I think some people went through that experience most productively. Others got poisoned. You know, the fumes overtook them. The house blew up. So I have to take everything as a real, like, case-by-case basis. So the truth is, I don't know. Only that what I do know is that I personally am not where I was before. But there's all, you know. But I will conclude with, I recently was asked to write an article about living with uncertainty, which is kind of where we are. And my point as a myth person would be, could we reframe that, change living with uncertainty to navigating the mysteries? Navigating the mysteries has a lot more dignity in it, you know, especially when you're aging. You don't want to be just constantly living with uncertainty, you know. Fuck off. You know, Billy Connolly, or no, not Billy Connolly, I'm getting confused. Is Billy Connolly's wild twin is W.B. Yeats. And Yeats would say, you know, Yeats would say, sail to Byzantium. Sail to Byzantium. Rumi would say, build your boat like Noah. It makes no difference what your friends think of you. So I just hope there's something of that in all of this uncertainty. We choose to navigate mystery.
Well, I think that that's the most brilliant place to leave.
I think that does make a beautiful ending. Thank you so much, Martin.
Bless you. So nice to see your faces again.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
You know that project you've been working on, just chipping away at it, dreaming of the day you get to show it off? Then, when you're least expecting it, cancer. And finishing that project actually happens. I would know. I've been restoring this car for years, and today I'm giving it to my granddaughter. It's her 16th birthday and 2 years since my cancer diagnosis.
Mom, you finished it?
Happy birthday, boo-boo. You keep making plans.
Visit OhioHealth.com/keepmakingplans to learn more.